This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and we're having our last interview with Dr. Daryl Lismore. How are you, Daryl?
I'm doing great, Chris. Thanks.
How are you? Excellent. What we're going to talk about today is something that people have been working at genetic-wise for hundreds and hundreds of years, and that is peewee grape varieties. First of all, can you pronounce peewee in the German?
No, in fact, I think the Germans are even starting to sort of almost rebrand them as pioneering wines because it's something that people can...
Yeah, it's pretty tough. I know. I've never did it. But what we want to do is I want to talk a wee bit about, from a genetic point of view, what's going on with peewees, and maybe look at what in New Zealand, because there's been a movement. We've been talking to Jim White, and he's brought in or helped to arrange bringing in peewee grape varieties, but they may not perform in New Zealand as well as maybe they performed in Italy and Germany where they came from. So that's what I want to look at. That sound good?
Fantastic.
Okay, so first of all, just for the listeners, just give us a very short, what is a peewee variety?
Peewees, which in many other breeding programs are just called DRVs, disease-resistant varieties, are vines that have been created by crossing Vitis vinifera, the wine grape, with other Vitis species that have come from environments, the same environments where powdery and downy mildew came from, generally Asian or American environments. Yeah, exactly. So these vines like Vitis rupestris, rotundifolia, have natural genes in their DNA that allow them to resist the infection by these mildews that Vitis vinifera doesn't have. And so you can take a wine grape like Chardonnay that produces a very good quality wine, cross it into one of these wild species, and generally do many subsequent back crosses to recover a whole lot of the Chardonnay genetics or the Vitis vinifera genetics, and at each step try to check that you're retaining the disease-resistant gene from the wild species. So you've got something that's mostly Vitis vinifera, makes a good quality wine, but also has a resistance gene from a species that could donate that.
And these things have been going, I hadn't realized it, but the first peewee grapes, or the first hybrids, if you like, were done in America almost as soon as they started growing grapes in America, because they found that the American grape varieties, whilst might be resistant to mold, they didn't taste very good.
That's right. Yeah. And in the Finger Lakes region, still the majority of what they grow are these disease resistant.
Because that was cold as well. They needed cold resistance.
That's right. Yeah.
And Vidal, I think, was one of the big success stories from
Absolutely,
there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So peewee grape varieties are hybrids, and they've been crossing them for hundreds of years, and they're getting... My understanding is they're getting to the point where they start to taste pretty good, and they've got resistance that you want, but not much else of the original species.
That's right. Yes, there's two things you're trying to do there is make sure that you can make good quality wine from them and recover all the Vitis vinifera genetics. And also they've progressed from having peewees or DRVs that have just a single resistance trait from one donor species and now have multiple resistance traits all stacked together.
Yeah, and that's the key thing, isn't it? That's what's the change now, is to build multiple layers of protection.
That's right. Yeah, if a plant has different reasons that it's resistant to a pathogen, completely redundant reasons, then it's far more resilient, because if it just has one, and you can just imagine how many billions and trillions of spores there are in a vineyard over a season, a small mutation that allows one of those spores to get around the plant's resilience will make that spore, that strain of the pathogen, outcompete all the others, and it just spreads like wildfire, and then it overcomes the resistance. But if you have another reason that spore can't infect it, it has no evolutionary advantage, and so it doesn't persist.
I want to look at the different types of resistance that plants can have, and I've put them into two categories. I don't know if... ChatGPT's helped me put them into two categories. I haven't been fair. Let's give Mr. GTP the credit that deserves. But there seems to be resistance that is DNA-based. Well, it's all DNA-based, isn't it? But there's DNA-based type of things that you can't see, and there's things that you can see. So one of them might be the plant develops a antifungal that you can't see, but another one might be that it has loose clusters. So that's it. So let's start with the easy one, which is the plant, I think it's called plant morphology.
That's right.
Is that what it's called?
Sure, which just means the physical structure of the plant.
Yeah, yeah. So let's start with, say, the leaves, because that seems to be the big thing there. What are the, do you know any of the sort of things that you might be looking for in a leaf?
Yeah, well, take every grapevine leaf, for example, has a waxy cuticle on the outside, a layer of wax that protects it from drying out, but also protects it from pathogens. And so the variation in that waxy cuticle can reduce the physical ability for the pathogen to get at the living tissue. Same thing for trichoderma, the leaf hairs as well. They can be present in different morphologies and different abundances, and that can also make a big difference too.
Why? Because the hair stops the spore getting on the leaf? Or
yeah, it just affects the ability for the leaf to dry out or airflow across the surface of the leaf. Yeah.
Okay, anything else?
So the stomata are the breathing holes on the leaf. They're the openings for gaseous exchange that have to be open for transpiration, but also they're the way that the spores can gain access to the interior of the leaf. So differences in the morphology, the physical structure and size of those stomata, the abundance of those stomata, can affect susceptibility to disease.
So does the mold get into the leaf? I thought it just sort of sat on the top.
I don't know that we know enough about whether the ability to access the interior of the leaf infects changes the infection rate.
Okay, and what about the epidermis?
So the epidermis is just the outer layer of cells on the leaf. And so that's what it's trying. Once you get past the cuticle, the next thing is the epidermis, and the epidermis, those cells have quite a robust cell wall. Plants have very strong cell walls, and so the chemical composition of that cell wall could affect the ability for a mildew to infect the plant.
Okay, it's a bit like us having hairy arms and then the skin on the... The one that most people talk about when we're talking about peewee vines, and it's very obvious, is the bunch. Because you can look at a grape variety, and some grape varieties are really tightly packed in there, and there's not much airflow. So what are you looking for in those sort of conditions?
Well, yeah, especially for things like botrytis, there haven't been necessarily resistance genes identified, but plants that have a longer pedicel, which is the little stalk that the individual grape berries are attached to, or have smaller berries, can have more open bunches, and that allows just more airflow through, so they don't end up with these damp regions that fungus can grow in the interior of the bunch.
So if you've got a longer stem and a smaller grape, that will just allow more airflow.
That's right.
Yeah, we were doing a podcast a while ago, and they were talking about, you know, sometimes the cluster of grapes rots from the inside out.
Yeah.
And you can look at a cluster and it goes, well, that's a lovely bunch of grapes, but inside it's just...
Yeah, it can get very warm. It hasn't had any airflow with the outside, and it's just been damp and humid.
And also the skin as well, because you've got...
That's a big one, yeah. The thickness of the berry skin as well, how robust that berry skin is.
Yeah, you think about Cabernet Sauvignon, which has a thick skin, or an Albarino, which has a thick skin, and that means what, the spore can't... Because the spore wants to get into the juicy bit in the middle, doesn't it?
The sugar's all on the inside there, yeah. That's the best nutrient source for it.
Yeah, yeah. And also, can there be any antifungal stuff on the skin, or are there other things on the skin that might help?
I'm not sure. They also have a cuticle, so that would affect it. That sort of the waxiness, and that's why some berries can be quite grey, and the composition of the chemicals that make up that wax also alter between varieties.
Okay. And then the last thing is obviously airflow. We mentioned airflow in the bunch, but airflow in the leaf canopy as well is really important. So what would be the characteristics there?
So that can be the leaf shape, the length of the branches, how open they are, how vigorous the plant grows. That's not only for spore transmission, but that could be for spraying as well. You have to more efficient spray application if you have a canopy that's much more open.
Yeah, yeah, because you want to penetrate the canopy, don't you? And if you've got a deep, if you've got a hedge, basically, you're not going to get the sprays in there.
Exactly. Big, flat leaves. Yeah, they don't let the air and the sprays and things penetrate nearly as much as sort of more open leaves.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Now that the hard one, DNA, because it's not just the way the plant is, it's also what's going on in the inside, isn't there?
That's right.
You can't see what's going on inside the plant, but I was reading they're looking for certain genetics or DNA bits like RUN1 and REN3 and REN4, and I don't really understand genetics too much, but what does that mean?
So in many cases, they treat it as if these are known genes, but in fact, a lot of cases, they're just a marker. Somebody's found a region of the DNA that if the plant has this, it has increased resistance to the organism. But we know that what must be happening within these regions, there are genes that allow the plant to trigger biochemical pathways, because those genes are responsible for the expression of enzymes that create a barrier to allowing the infection.
Mm. Does the plant have them on all the time, or does it wait until something turns up before it fires away?
Yeah, so they are certainly receptor molecules, but in most cases, pathogen stress responses are a cascade type signal. So it'll be a signaling molecule or recognize something, and that will cause a set of genes to all be upregulated. So you could have very generic genes that cause, for example, the apoptosis, the cell death in the area, that suddenly ramp up. They're kind of lying there dormant, and they suddenly ramp up because of something has triggered that cascade of enzymes.
Is that why when you look at something like powdery mildew on a leaf and the leaf's there, it's all brown? Is that the leaf dying deliberately to try and stop the powdery mildew infecting green bits?
Yeah.
Or is it, I always thought it was the powdery mildew just killing the leaf.
In most cases, I think it's the plant killing its cells to stop the infection.
Okay, so that's an example of where it's detected some powdery mildew or downy mildew on the leaf, and it's gone, right, okay, the way to stop this, it's just to chop it off.
Sacrificial loss of that part of the organism. Yeah.
Yeah,
plants are great because they can grow everything back, unlike us. All the different tissue types can grow back. Like, you can grow more leaves, you can grow more branches. We prune them over winter.
I was reading that some of these peewees have got different ways of detecting different versions of, say, powdery mildew, because not all powdery mildew is the same, is it?
That's right.
And is that a problem in New Zealand? Have we got different powdery mildews in New Zealand, or have we got different downy mildews? Or
that's right. You've got this evolutionary battle between the host and the pathogen. One's trying to evolve resistance, and the one's trying to evolve to get around that resistance. And so they're constantly changing. And I think sometimes people think of these resistance genes as, if you have one, you're good, you don't need a spray, and if you don't, they're susceptible. But in reality, they are conferred degrees of tolerance to different strains of these fungus. And in some strains might be really unable to infect a plant with certain resistance genes, and other strains it might be different. So for example, the strains that we've got have had time to evolve in our own ecosystem, and different isolates have spread. And so a big question about DRVs, especially when they are bred in other countries, is they were selected for their performance in that environment and their resistance to their local strains. How will they perform here and in resistance to our local strains?
Yeah, so some of the peewee varieties that work really well overseas, it may not even detect that there's powdery mildew on the skin to respond to that.
Yeah, or they might reduce the infection rate by 30% rather than 60% or something like that. It's probably sort of more quantitative than that. And because we've seen, for example, that if you have this disease resistance gene A and B, having both of them together is not necessarily better than having one or the other. So they're not additive. They're obviously complex interactions going on with the expression of these traits that depends also on the strain of the powdery mildew that they're exposed to.
When you look at a plant, you can clearly look at things like the leaf and the waxiness of the surface and the size of the grapes and all that sort of thing. But do you get in and look at sort of how the plant responds to the powdery mildew or the downy mildew on the leaf? Like, do you say, look, oh, it's killing off the leaf really well, you know, which doesn't sound like a good idea, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or maybe the cell walls have suddenly got thicker because it's got this mold or mildew on it.
Yeah, there are chemicals you can test to validate that stress response, but the simplest thing for us is really, if I apply the spores of the powdery mildew, can it start to grow on the leaf? And so we take leaf discs, we give them a very standardized exposure to a concentration of spores, we allow them to grow, and then
New Zealand
we store
spores.
Them relative to one another. Exactly, New Zealand isolates that we've had to very carefully purify, basically, out of a wild environment that has thousands or tens of thousands of microorganisms, get a pure isolate of that, and then measure them against the plant material.
You've been working with Jim White. He went over to Italy and found different peewee grape varieties he liked. Did you advise him on that at all?
Not precisely about which ones or anything like that. We've also been speaking to the same breeders in Europe and have talked to him about the traits that they'd like to select for. The problem, as you say, because of this difference in response to environments and isolates has mostly meant for us what we really want to get in is the most diversity we can. There are obviously viticultural traits. He's interested in plants that they think they can will make a style of wine that's useful for their business, and that's great. I'm sort of agnostic about that, but I think when from a genetics perspective, our problem has been a lack of diversity. So getting in plants that are as diverse as possible, to have as many resistance genes as possible, stands us in the best stead.
As a geneticist, you want to have things to play with, don't you?
Yeah, I think we've got to have options. I'll let the industry narrow them down. I want to present them with a sort of a menu of options, and then they can tell me, well, this is the one we like and that's the one we didn't.
If you look at sort of Piwi development, Germany obviously led the way because it is a German word.
Sure.
But you've got Italy, you've got... is it US? Yeah, they've been doing it for...
Cornell,
they started it.
Davis, they've had big breeding programs for decades.
Yeah, do you think that would be something that New Zealand might be looking at? Or is it just that you just don't have the... You don't have the genes in here at the moment, or...?
Until recently, that's true. It's both because the industry was very focused on the varieties that we grow and market well, but also we just didn't have the genetics. To some extent, there's been, because we have a big program to produce clonal diversity, I think the industry has felt like, okay, what about a complementary research program to look at alternative varieties? And so we're seeing increased investment in that. But also, we now do have a lot of these resistance genes. We've been working quite hard, as have our partners at BSI, to import these new genetics so that we can do crossings and grow them up here. So typically we bring them in by seed. It's a far easier way to bring them through biosecurity, far cheaper, and lets us bring in much more diversity. But also the nurseries are bringing in material that's been commercially proven, and they can only pick a handful of different individuals, and then they can bring them in through a slower quarantine mechanism.
So you can plant them up. You just want the genetic material, don't you, to play with?
That's right. I want seeds from crosses that have 4, 5, 6 different sources of resistance. And then we can grow up a few hundred seed and say which one really works well in New Zealand, produces a high quality wine, and this could be the next New Zealand varietal that could do really well.
I heard I can't remember who it was who said this. We've done a lot of podcasts in New Zealand over the while, but they were saying that New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc is quite unusual. People say, oh no, it's the climate that drives it. I've heard someone say maybe we just got lucky that the clone that we brought in might have just been a little bit mutated that creates this lovely aromatic style. Because if you look at Sonsen, Marlborough Sauvignon is very, very different. And whether New Zealand, and you've said earlier in earlier podcasts, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc is very homogenous. There's not a lot of clonal differences there. So could it be that part of the New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc story is we just got lucky and got a mutated Sauvignon Blanc that produces this very aromatic style of wine?
Yeah, it's not impossible. And that's kind of comes back to the central question of genetics, of nature versus nurture. It's very hard to know what is the environment and what is the genetics of the plant. And so I think that's what makes it exciting when it's applied to winemaking. It's both the genetics and picking the right starting material, but then it's also where you grow it, how you make the wine, that determines the quality that ends up in the bottle.
All right then, Daryl, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Chris.